This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. In this week's personal ad column, carbon capture companies seek emissions partners in our area. The carbon sequestration companies CO2Lock and Cielo Carbon Solutions are looking to draw the carbon out of a refinery, a pulp mill, a greenhouse, or some CO2-emitting facility in our region. The duo wants to take the carbon dioxide just over 50 kilometers southwest of Prince George between the northeast side of Naltespe or Bobtail Lake and the southwest corner of Bobtail Mountain Provincial Park, where a carbon sequestration project is taking shape. CO2Lock, an FPX nickel mining subsidiary, and Victoria-based Cielo Carbon Solutions, the Canadian partner of Seattle-based Carbon Quest, came together to build an injection well there. Why here in north central BC? Well, the area happens to be reasonably close to development infrastructure, and it hosts a significant deposit of brucite, also known as magnesium hydroxide. Often found next to nickel, this mineral has a rare ability to crystallize carbon dioxide. Upon pumping a water and CO2 solution into the deposit, a transformation takes place underground over a period of about 9 months, whereupon the brucite becomes magnesium carbonate, or magnesite, which actually has a role in agricultural fertilizer. Later this 2025, Cielo will initially inject about 200 tons of carbon dioxide with its first tanker and plans to ramp up its sequestration to 30,000 tons in 2026, with ambitions to reach up to 1 million tons annually. The project could run for about 20 years at that rate. But why do we need this? Well, this partnership sees itself as addressing a technology gap. While fossil fuels continue to be used in our energy distribution systems, this method reduces pollution and has a side potential to manufacture liquid CO2 for other industrial purposes. For insight on how this technology works and just how carbon dioxide sequestration can play a role in our northern BC economy, we turn to the CEO of Cielo Carbon Solutions, Jonathan Sipos, during the Future Fuels Forum held at the House of Ancestors, Ada Dune Bayo.
What are some of the hopes that you have for this industry and the future of it? And what are some of the central obstacles as you see it in getting that done?
Natural gas is critical to the British Columbia economy and to the Canadian economy. We cannot shut it down. We cannot slow it down. We need to embrace it. We need to use more of it. But I think there's a way to do it cleanly and responsibly, and that's where point source carbon capture comes in. Our technology allows us to capture up to 99% of the carbon dioxide and natural gas emissions. So when you burn it, combust it, we can get rid of 99% of the CO2, which can then be sequestered underground, in effect, making it green. You can just look at a compressor engine as one example. We're currently working on a deal with Tourmaline Energy and Emissions Reductions Alberta in conjunction with the NGIF to put a carbon capture facility onto one of their compressor stations outside of Edson, Alberta, to do just this, to capture the CO2 and make it green, which really brings down the carbon footprint of natural gas use, and I think really gets rid of the political hurdles that are facing increased natural gas usage. Applicable to northern BC is distributed power generation. We have a tremendous challenge up here of getting power long distances, but we have a lot of natural gas that is spread out. What we could do is start using that natural gas either through natural gas-based generators, reciprocating engines, or if we're really trying to be forward-thinking here, start bringing in natural gas-based fuel cells, attaching carbon capture to that and generating clean power at a very attractive price to distribute our power generation, get rid of the large transmission lines, and really increase the durability of the electrical grid, all while supporting our fossil fuel sector. So we see the ability to generate electricity with natural gas and carbon capture as being a terrific solution for the next 25 to 50 years in northern British Columbia.
To further explore the nuances of the carbon capture process, we reached out to Dr. Steve Helley, Associate Professor of Engineering at UMBC, who focuses on waste and wastewater treatment, production of renewable fuels and chemicals, fermentation modeling and optimization, and bioprocess engineering. We take you to that conversation now, where Steve explains how much carbon dioxide can typically be captured from flue or exhaust gas.
So the energy to capture goes up as you capture more and more of it. So it's relatively easy to capture half the gas and maybe even up to 90% of the gas. But then to get that last bit takes a lot more energy, a lot more cost. It goes up exponentially as you capture more and more of it. And then once you've captured it, you're also going to be losing some of it. There are going to be leaks as you move it around. You have to off-gas some of the pressure, so there's boil-off gases. So you're going to lose another 5%. So realistically, you're looking at, you know, capturing 85%.
Significant to some degree,
yeah.
But not a pollution elimination.
No. And if you look at operating carbon capture plants, I think the maximum they're at is 80%, and some are at 50%.
Is there a improved energy ratio in that type of process rather than, say, compressing that captured CO2 into, say, liquid CO2 for industrial use later on, or sequestering it in some other method?
Not very much, but when you capture the CO2, so CO2 is a gas, very low density as a gas. So when you capture it, if you want to move it anywhere, you got to compress it. So if it's going to be moved down by truck, you got to compress it to get it into a small, relatively small volume. So there's a lot of energy used in that stage just to transport it. I assume when they pump it underground, it will be in a compressed form as well. So you're not avoiding the compression stage.
The advantage of that could be instead that it doesn't leak out of the deposit in some way,
yeah.
So easily
if it
gets mineralized.
If it's in the right geology where it will react quickly with the rocks, then you have a much greater certainty of the permanence. So when they store CO2 underground, the idea is that 99% of it will stay underground forever. And if it is in places where it's going to react with the rocks relatively quickly, then that helps ensure that process.
One of the central criticisms facing carbon capture technology is the amount of energy the process uses. CEO Jonathan Sipos provides a response.
I think it really starts with transitioning public opinion on fossil fuel usage. And again, that's what I find so powerful about carbon capture, because we can deploy this at a university, an airport, a hospital, and really show the general public that carbon capture is not just for remote locations, for large oil and gas processing facilities, but we can bring this to urban centers to show people that, yes, through technology, we can make green the use of it. And I think that's so critical to change the public narrative on natural gas and get rid of this ideology that burning natural gas is inherently bad. If we can get rid of the carbon dioxide, which we can do, which we're already doing, we can completely change this thought process, which is very powerful for Canada.
Within the technology that you use within your process, as these techniques are developed and modified over time, are you open to adapting to other methods of carbon extraction and different ways of approaching the issue?
Certainly. So historically, there's been three ways that you can do carbon capture. You can do amine-based solutions, which are very large towers. They work very well at large scale. You can do temperature swing. Temperature swing requires a lot of on-site heat, which most places do not always have. And then there's the third way, which is what we can provide, which is called pressure swing adsorption. And so using pressure swing, all you need, the only input is electricity, not a crazy amount of it, and using pressure and a solid adsorbent, basically a pellet-like material, we can first get the water out of the flue gas and then under pressure put it into a pressure vessel where the solid adsorbent adsorbs the carbon dioxide but lets the nitrogen and oxygen go through to the other side. We then reverse the process, change from a pressure to a vacuum. These little pellet-like materials release the carbon dioxide. We then have a virtually 99.9% pure CO2 stream on the other side, which we can either leave as a gas, we can recompress it, we can turn it into a liquid. And so it's a very simple process that also has the benefit of being able to scale from about 800 tons per annum of carbon capture all the way up to about 100,000 tons, which lets us play in a much larger field than historical carbon capture technologies. And so it's been a very innovative approach. We partner with a company in the States called CarbonQuest, who today actually have 6 carbon capture facilities operating in New York City.
When we think of typical industries that require liquid CO2 for whatever they're doing, for example, maybe carbonation at a brewery, where does that CO2 typically come from, and what advantages does this play in or create efficiencies in?
This was really interesting to me when we dove into this business a number of years ago. Every year in North America, there's something like 15 million tons of carbon dioxide sold for industrial purposes. Coca-Cola in their global portfolio uses 5 million tons of carbon dioxide per annum. And so there's a massive industry out there, from welding shops to hospitals to food and beverage processing facilities. All of these people need to buy their CO2, and traditionally it's trucked very long distances, generally from the central or midwest of the United States and from central Canada. And so the farther you go from there, your transportation costs skyrocket. What we see as being a very powerful alternative to that is localizing carbon capture, for example, here in Prince George, around our heavy industry, and then recycling that CO2 back into the local economy where it's needed. This provides a cost savings. This also reduces CO2 emissions from transportations and provides a revenue generator for those wanting to capture their CO2 and sell it back into the market.
Where the CO2 is produced, how are they getting their CO2, do you know?
There's a number of different places they'll draw it from, but traditionally fertilizer. For example, my understanding is the majority of BC's CO2 comes from Oregon and is actually trained up and then transported from there. So it's an interesting logistical challenge. And you can look at the greenhouse example, where a lot of them burn natural gas to heat their greenhouses and then also have to go out and procure CO2 to feed back into the plants. This provides a bit of a closed loop scenario. The same thing could be said for a brewery distillery, where you're burning your natural gas to create your steam. You could then capture that CO2, upgrade it to food and beverage grade through our process, and then re-inject it through carbonization back into your plant, to your bottled products. It's a very, I think, modern way to think about a closed loop economy here, to make green the use of natural gas, create a recycled good, and provide a win for everybody.
Thanks for sharing your connection and your vision for future fuels.
Terrific. Thank you as well, Ian, and have a great rest of your day.
With more efficient technology, a lot of possibilities are at play. To zoom out further with us, we go back to Associate Professor of Engineering at UMBC, Steve Helley.
We have a project here locally, the sequestration site. UMBC itself has a gas-assisted hog fuel combustion heat station. We'll kind of see where carbon capture comes into play in our local economy here. But the thing to think about is, again, energy input and whether or not there might be an alternate way of
electrification. It's just what it comes down to. Yeah. Electrify as much as you can. So electrify your heating, electrify your hot water, electrify your mobility around town. It's either cost comparable. Well, it varies. I would say you're going to save a bit of money, but the carbon footprint is a fraction because we have clean electricity. So switching away from fossil fuels to electrification with clean electricity, you're carbon dioxide emissions go down by a couple orders of magnitude.
One of the ways in which electrification can work on a very large scale is in something like a super grid. For example, in China is building one version at least of this very large grid technology where they're having very, very large electrical towers built across the country. So electricity generated on one side of the country can be transferred over to the other side during peak hours on the other side of the country where it's no longer needed on, say, the eastern side. It can be transferred to the west or vice versa. And the infrastructure required to do it is being transferred in direct current electricity instead of alternating current, which is what our whole grid right now is built on, alternating current. And building a separate direct current infrastructure is another order of magnitude. And again, building all these towers requires steel. You need big copper cables. Mining is involved in that as well. The metallurgical processes to create the steel requires a certain amount of energy input. When you look at the system's overview of creating this infrastructure, it's difficult at this point to say which one would require a net more or less amount of energy to actually create and deliver.
No.
But from what you've been describing, would moving in the direction of electrification overall require less energy overall?
Definitely. Using electricity compared to fossil fuels, way more efficient. Fossil fuels are limited by the second law of thermodynamics, heat engines. There have been a number of studies looking at if we build out a 100% renewable grid, wind, solar, high voltage, long distance transmission lines, all of that, what the upfront energy and carbon impact of that will be. And it is significant, but you then, once you've built it, you have no more emissions. So it's a one-time sort of pulse as you build out this stuff. And yeah, it's significant, but it's not insurmountable. And something that if we want to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to zero, it's something we need to do.
Steve, thanks so much for joining us in CIFR Studios today and being patient as I try to articulate my thoughts and words.
Energy systems are complicated.
I've learned that today, if nothing else. That was UMBC's Dr. Steve Helley, who holds a doctorate in chemical engineering and a title of associate professor here at the University of Northern British Columbia in engineering. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFR Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program.
Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca.